Hey guys, it's Nick. We have an emergency release right now. We had planned on doing Star Trek VI, which, don't worry, spoiler, will be next week in honor of the new Star Trek movie. However, due to a terrible experience we all had, we've decided to do an unusual and rare kind of myopia on-screen edition where we have all together sat down and watched Independence Day Resurgence. And consider this a PSA to make sure none of you ever watch it. Enjoy.
Hey, tune in to the Ratchet Retrocast, your source for all things retro and steampunk.
Crazy up here. I can't take it anymore. Tell me how much you miss me.
You know how much I miss you.
I can't believe it's been 20 years. Still gonna take your father into the anniversary?
We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him.
On this day in 1996, the world escaped the clutches of extinction.
Your father was the bravest man I've ever seen.
We all lost someone we love.
But in their sacrifice, we found the technology to build a stronger and safer Earth. Because our survival is only possible when we stand together.
Didn't. It happened on its own 2 days ago.
Twenty years ago, when we destroyed the mothership, we detected a burst in an X-band frequency directed toward deep space.
Looks like someone picked up the phone and answered.
A distress call. They're coming back.
That is definitely bigger than the last one.
It has its own gravity.
What goes up must come down.
Shouldn't we be nervous?
Yeah.
Why are they screaming?
They're not screaming.
They're celebrating.
We could use our isolation chamber that contains their telepathy.
Where's my dad?
How did he get in here?
Someone get him out of there.
He overrode the system.
Sir, please unlock the door.
Don't you worry about me. Just get as many answers as you can.
She has arrived.
Who is she?
Our whole lives built up to this moment.
It's touchdown over the Atlantic.
Which part?
All of it.
Make them pay.
Not going out there to make friends.
We've got to remind them Earth is not for the taking.
All fighters evade, evade!
You are screwing with the wrong species.
I had years to get us ready.
We're going down!
We never had a chance.
We didn't last time either. We convinced an entire generation that this is a battle that we could win. We sacrifice for each other, no matter what the cost. And that's worth fighting for.
It's the 4th of July. So let's show them some fireworks.
Hold on!
They like to get the landmarks.
$1 billion.
Oh, geez, okay.
Internationally, it just hit 266.
So it's only made a $66 million profit at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, the best part of this is special effects. However, we're gonna do a rolling start on this one because it's an unusual episode anyway.
Sure.
So, welcome, guys. This is a different kind of podcast. Obviously, we've done some new movies before. We did Jurassic World, which we generally were nonplussed by, but this movie was so bad. We immediately thought we should record our thoughts on it. We are talking today about 2016's Independence Day : Resurgence. And this, I guess, is a myopia on screen edition. We will be spoiling this movie. If you still want to see it, you should. Well, maybe not. I guess you'll have to listen to see what we have to say about it. But we will be spoiling it. So, like all of our movies, spoiler alert, just most of them are older than 10 years. So we can go around the table. I'm Nick Hoffman, editor-in-chief and owner of Dude Letter Podcasting. And?
Hello, this is Daniel, and the aliens probed me sexually.
Mm.
Matthew W. Quinn, webmaster of the world according to Quinn.
And?
Tom Herman, I drank half a handle of Jameson after watching this movie. So.
Well, let's start there with your alcoholism. This is an intervention.
We need you to drink more to forget.
So I guess normally we would toss to one of you to do the plot synopsis. Daniel, you want to do this one?
Sure, I can give it a try. It's been 20 years since the aliens, I believe they're called the Harvesters now, invaded Earth and destroyed a lot of our cities, but we prevailed due to all-American moxie. Anyway, in that 20 years, our technology is far advanced thanks to all the crashed spaceships. And in Africa, there's still a spaceship that's been sending out a distress beacon. Jeff Goldblum goes to investigate with Charlotte Gainsbourg, who's now his love interest because his ex-fiancée is dead or missing or an alien or something. And they realize that the aliens are coming back to finish the job that they started in the first movie. They also discover a mysterious sphere that might hold the key to defeating the aliens once and for all. And there you go. We're away. Oh, yeah. And Dr. Oaken is somehow still alive. And Bill Pullman is crazy. And Randy Quaid is still dead.
I'll take it.
Is Francisco Franco still dead, too?
My understanding is yes.
Go ahead.
Very, very much Seinfeld in not that it matters, but is Dr. Oaken gay now?
I believe that's what they implied, although how he got a gay lover in a 20-year coma.
Ah, no. Actually, I can answer this because I did watch the first movie after the second movie as a palate cleanser. The guy who's supposed to be his lover or love interest, or we're assuming is, because it's never directly stated, is actually in the first movie.
What?
He's the doctor at Area 51. He's the one that comes out and tells President Whitmore that his wife has too much internal bleeding.
What? That was him?
That I'm almost positive, like kind of looking at it, that they're the same person.
Oh, that just upsets me even more now.
Actually, I would say just the opposite. That means there's actually a story here. He might be like a Florence Nightingale effect or something.
You see him right next to Dr. Oaken as they go into the clean room.
I'm not going to deny it. Actually, I was going to look really quick if I could find any of these people's names.
I was just so confused by that because they seemed to know each other, but he was never directly referenced. And I always thought Dr. Oaken was sort of the secluded scientist with no sex drive whatsoever. So just suddenly giving him any romantic interest just seemed kind of weird.
Dr. Isaacs. In fact, he is in both.
Oh!
I also kind of liked Robert Loggia coming back as General Gray, although...
For like 1 second?
He has not aged well.
No. He's also dead now.
I do love that Jeff Goldblum's dad still also drives like an old Jewish man.
Yeah, we should talk a little bit about Judd Hirsch. Here's the problem with this movie, at least for me, and I know, Matt, you want to disagree, which is good. We should have this discussion, but I think this movie, I think we'd agree that it's bad. That I think we all agree on. That's why I wanted to do this. But I think the problem is, in some ways, this would have been better if the first movie hadn't been the same thing, because it goes out of its way to bring back old characters that we don't care about, and the only one that's done really successfully is Dr. Oken, because he's the comic relief now. Mm-hmm. The thing is, Jeff Goldblum does his Jeff Goldblum-y Jeff Goldblum, and I love me Jeff Goldblum.
If I may interject here, comedy in the loosest sense, because one of the jokes involves his ass hanging out of a hospital nightgown, and we see every second of it.
Well, I tell you what, it wasn't a stunt ass either. Brent Spiner... got some middle-aged old man ass.
Yeah, it's no longer smooth as an android bottom.
Data, stop it!
But, I mean, like, the thing is, Jeff Goldblum in the first movie is the same exact character. The problem is he's playing off against Will Smith, who's very charismatic, so he gets to be the straight man. In this movie, he's playing against cardboard, so he seems even more cardboardy than usual.
Yeah, he plays off his father. Well, who plays his father?
Judd Hirsch.
It's like for the beginning of the movie, that's them going back and forth and bantering, and then later it's him and Will Smith. It's a wonderful setup.
Okay, so we should talk about some of the new characters they introduced to round out this cast, because...
Oh, I completely left them out because they're not worth mentioning.
Oh, discount Thor?
Well,
yes.
Thor's brother Loki is in this movie. No, Liam Hemsworth is the...
All-American rebel, baby.
Here's the problem. You would think, if you were writing a sequel to a movie, that the star of the movie would be Will Smith's son, because apparently Will Smith didn't bother to show up for this movie.
Yeah, he's referenced somewhere in the companion materials. He died in a training accident.
Well, no, he's referenced in the movie as having died in a training accident.
Oh, I thought they showed his picture.
No, they said it. But am I the only one? Because I just think back to the space program. And when some of our specific astronauts, when they did something impressive, like first of their kind, all of that, it was generally afterwards, like in one specific instance, I'm trying to remember, the President of the United States grounded them. It was like, all right, you're done.
Oh, yeah, like Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong.
I could see President Whitmore doing the same thing
to
Captain Hillard after this war. Like, you are an international hero.
He should be the Secretary of Defense or something.
Yeah. Yes.
He should be that guy who...
Or the Joint Chief.
I've stared the alien in the face. He should be someone... I mean, hell, even have a Captain America, I'm sick of being a poster boy for things I want to fight montage. And then he dies. Fine. But...
Okay, the best prop in this movie exists, though, because he's dead. There's a noble painting of him next to the Oval Office that we see several times. I want that next to my poster of Kramer from Seinfeld of the painting, next to the giant watercolor of Bill Murray from The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, because there's got to be this wall somewhere of someone.
Can you put it next to that poster you have of Vigo?
Oh, Vigo the Carpathian. We need to have an art exhibit of famous movie paintings, because that one was pretty spectacular.
Oh, it was fantastic.
Now, was there a building named after him? Because I know they named a hospital after Bill Pullman's dead wife.
I think they named a hangar after him or something, or the space base. I can't remember.
At Area 51, maybe.
Yeah, no, they did. The hangar at Area 51 was like the Hillard or something.
The problem is, if you were writing a sequel to this, since Will Smith decided he wasn't going to be around, you would think that his son would be the star. However, they casted a guy named Jesse Usher. And Jesse Usher is as charismatic as that painting. He is boring. And the problem is, Liam Hemsworth is not uncharismatic, but he's not a comedian. He's not funny. He doesn't... So there's none of the back and forth of anything.
He lacks timing.
He lacks everything. He's just a handsome guy. But generally, if you put a handsome guy, you want him out of his element. That's kind of why the Thor movies work. He's a guy who everyone's just like, oh, Thor, and then he accidentally smashes his cups because he doesn't understand cultural morals.
More.
Yes. Right, and that's funny.
I demand a horse.
And that works. Liam Hemsworth is just like, I'm sorry I nearly killed you.
And the guy just walks up and punches him, which is pretty much the best dialogue he delivers, being punched in the face.
Pretty much.
There's nothing. There's no charm here.
And then just kind of going in beyond the characters, just kind of expanding out. One of the things, rewatching the first, and I think I kind of like watching the first after the second for a multitude of reasons, is that the first one does a very good job of making this an international affair. Whereas in this one, we get this one scene of Hong Kong and one scene of London. It mainly takes place around Area 51, and you kind of see little blips around the U.S. Whereas the first one, you get news feeds from Russia. You see certain things happening in other parts of the world, but you also have, when you're getting near the end and it's like, all right, we need to mount our offensive against them, we bring in Israel, we bring in the Middle East, we bring in China, all of this stuff gets brought in to, all right, we're going to launch a counteroffensive. And it really engages you in a, all right, you know, shit's about to get real, and this is a world-spanning, you know, a crisis.
Well, and to build off of that, this movie has zero stakes for two reasons. First of all, like Daniel mentioned earlier and you mentioned to a bit, no one has any timing. There's no sense of urgency, and there's no stakes being slowly raised. Like, they try to emulate the very kind of script writing 101, have a clock kind of thing, but it never really pays off. There's no ticking clock. There's no threat.
The closest we get is a scene with these guys on a boat, a fishing boat, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean watching the aliens drill down into the Earth's core.
But we don't care about them.
No, we don't.
Guys, you have an hour now.
Yeah, that's
literally.
And they are literally gold diggers. It's
yeah, but I mean,
them will do it for $100 million.
$100 billion.
Oh,
like,
it was a million.
Done. No, it was billion.
It was billion.
It's an impossible amount.
It was
of money.
Million because they said there's $100 million in gold in the ship they're trying to sell.
No, I think they asked for an obscene amount.
Doesn't matter because they're bad characters.
Yes, they are bad characters.
Well, and then the second part
Dronsky,
of it.
Dronsky.
Well, the second part of it is Thomas's synopsis, the first movie, and Daniel's kind of, you know, tag is that the first one we survive via American grit and ingenuity like every 1940s and 50s sci-fi film.
Mm-hmm.
We're fighting spaceships with F-16s, you know, where we use an old shitty Mac to hack it, which doesn't make sense. But we're willing to buy it because there's a certain amount of entertainment value in this idea that we can do it. Whatever it is, we can. I mean, we're going to do another recording tonight. Spoiler alert, we're doing The Core. They literally hack all of space, just like DJ Qualls hacks the Earth. I would rather watch Jeff Goldblum hack something all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Here, they start in the, I guess, present, but with alien technology. I don't care. I can't relate to a giant space laser. And when it doesn't work, I get frustrated. Rather than when an F-16 or a nuke doesn't penetrate an alien hull, I get crestfallen. That's the difference. If it's technology I can't understand, why would I care? Like, ooh, I'm more pissed at them, right? Because they know how the shields work now. Why don't they make a laser that blasts past the shields?
Well, that's what they do on the fighter planes. The couple zaps and the alien fighters, you know, crumble.
Yes, but not
randomly, and it's no way explained as to how the lasers are suddenly able to work.
Yeah, or how you overpower them. Like,
if you see the first movie, whenever you see a missile hitting the shield, you see the impact spreading out.
Yeah.
So a laser beam would punch the shield at one spot, like stabbing a bulletproof vest with a knife.
Well, they never explained that in the movie, though, which is
It's one of those times where you needed to tell. You couldn't just show.
Yeah.
Especially since what they were showing, it's all CGI. Now, the effects, I think, looked great, but it's a lot of people not knowing where to look at things and then being – and then – well, I guess to wit, not a lot is actually told.
I like the effects in the first one better because they were actually physical stuff. I mean, somebody made a model of the White House and blew it up on camera.
They turned it on its side and blew it up. Like
somebody
built
an alien suit and an alien rubber dummy in order to put in that tank. It looked great. This just, it looks like a cartoon.
Well, and the aliens do too much. Sorry, Matt, were you going to say something?
Not.
Well, I mean, okay, so the thing was that I think doesn't work.
Think about good old American know-how, the atomic bomb came from Germany. All those Jewish physicists the Nazis drove out. So, I mean, good old American know-how.
Wait,
what are you talking about? You're talking about good old American know-how. Stealing alien technologies, we've been stealing other people's technology for 200 years.
I'm not sure.
I'm not getting it. The idea is humanity against the world, right?
and stealing technology is not really what we did, because
I think the point of this isn't so much that it's not so much an objection to stealing technology. It's just that it's never explained how this technology works and to any of the audience members. These characters have no reason to explain it.
I mean, no one in the general audience really fully understands how an F-18, all the intricacies, but they understand what a fighter pilot does, what a fighter jet does. They kind of understand that. They understand nuclear bomb, big, bad. You know,
it's like saying in Top Gun, they don't have to explain how the missile lock works. We just take for granted that it works because it's familiar technology. Mm-hmm. But when our opening scene is a giant robot that looks like something out of the game Descent is assembling a giant laser contraption, why bother?
Even in Star Wars, the laser cannons look like 1940s gunner ships. Yeah, it looks somewhat familiar.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, like, that's the other thing. They wanted this to be a hybrid of everything. The first movie is a hybrid of different genres. We have the rom-com intro with Will Smith and his wife is like, the kid comes in, I'm shooting aliens. And he's like, oh, that's adorable. Let me sleep in the...
Suspense.
We have a suspense movie. We have a thriller. We have a monster movie. We have every layer. And we have Top Gun, right? A bit. This, they instead parody almost alien movies. Because there's literally aliens. There's Starship Troopers. There's movies that do it better. That's the shame, really.
We needed Mars Attacks, too. That's what we needed.
Yeah. And the thing is, this movie, the first one, let's be fair, we like, but not everyone does. It has maybe 60% of Rotten Tomatoes. Roger Ebert famously panned it so much that Roland Emmerich made him the incompetent mayor in his next movie, Godzilla. Mayor Ebert. This is being panned pretty much universally. It has less than a 25% on Rotten Tomatoes, and even lower on Metacritic, because Metacritic is apparently filled with assholes. unfortunately, though, it's going to make another movie, because we are set up with you're going to believe this. It's literally like, we're going to have another movie. Brent Spiner comes out wearing pants, for God's sake, this time.
Oh, God.
But he comes out saying, we now can do interstellar travel. We'll take the war to them. Ooh. It's literally, we're going to have a sequel, which hopefully Jeff Goldblum will have the common sense to not be a part of.
That's really counting your chickens before they hatch with this sort of
movie. It was very much I'm praying that it ends up being like the ending for Super Mario Brothers, where Princess Daisy runs in and you go, you're never going to believe this. Mario goes, no, I believe. And then they just cut. And, you know, it's like, we're going to get another movie. It's like, no, you're not.
No.
Have we mentioned the queen yet in this movie? Because it's content to rip off aliens just that much.
Oh, yeah. No, not just aliens, but let's have some Kaiju Aega for some fun. Like,
even though that just makes the aliens that much worse because they don't look believable anymore.
And can we explain how a ship blows up? Blows up. And somehow the queen survives.
Yeah, even if she had personal shielding, but the amount of just, she was right next to like four or five quote unquote cold fusion bombs, which are supposedly more powerful than nukes.
Well, I mean, and I guess B,
that blew up the whole ship around her.
This disproves the whole first movie in some ways, because we're told that they're very human-like in some ways, right? They breathe oxygen, they drink water.
They're comparable to tolerances to heat and light, yeah.
They need the biomechanical suits as a way to make them stronger, but like other than their weird squid-like appearance, they're very human-ish. We don't have giant people who are the queens of them. They're destined to make them much more like, I don't know, like bees. They really want them to be bees.
And they contradict the whole thing, like if they have a queen, if you kill the queen, all of the ones attached to her die. After the fall of the Area 51 destroyer in the first movie, you still see alien fighters flying around. So some of them survived, presumably the death of whatever was commanding them on the mothership.
Mm-hmm.
And in the interquel novel I'm reading now, there's wars that go on after July 4th when the alien survivors are finished off.
Right.
And now suddenly everyone dies because of they kill the kaiju.
Well, it also is upsetting, too, because the only time something's scary is when you don't know that much about it. And it's kind of the same mistake Aliens made, but this does it on an even bigger scale. I mean, the less we know about these creatures, the more frightening and terrifying they are. And we learned everything we need to know the first one. They're a race that goes from planet to planet and destroys everything.
Here's a question.
Well, in the first movie, they settle planets and live on them until they use them all up. None of this crap about pulling out the planet's core.
No, and let's talk about them being similar to humanity. they have what, you know, like a couple dozen aliens sitting at Area 51 from the previous Worf that are alive.
Yeah.
How are they? They're still in their suits. How are they eating? 20 years. I'm sorry. You do not have a food source that'll last that long. Like,
well, I mean, and it's not even that they're aliens and they're aliens that die. It's because the first movie, I mean, it's 96. They're cribbing a little bit from X-Files. There's this idea that there's an alien race that we're dealing with and managing. This one, there's just so little charming. Like, the aliens might as well be a different species. Like, the movie doesn't matter. Like, why make this a sequel if the first movie didn't matter at all?
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, and we can get into this more and more, but eventually we're just kicking the fact that this isn't well assembled, which, I mean, I don't think anyone would argue with.
Well, and here's another one that the first movie had. It had a human antagonist rolling through it. You know, not a full not evil, but an indefinite antagonist, the Secretary of Defense, or
The Secretary of you mean
the former CIA guy,
the chief of staff, and is, you know, keeping all those things to himself and away from the president, and keeping things slow and all of that.
Whose actor has also unfortunately passed away, so he was spared the shame of being in this movie.
Yeah.
Yes, but I mean, and it was kind of enjoyable. There really wasn't that character, like, you know, something to, you know, to point your, like, you know, your anger as things are going wrong and you realize that, you know, somebody could have done something sooner.
And they even hired William Fichtner to be the chief of staff or whatever, the chairman of Joint Chiefs. And he looks like a bad guy. He could have been a bad guy.
Especially after he becomes president. I mean, you would expect,
yeah.
Spoiler alert, by the way, all the cabinet and the president dies, so they make him president.
When they destroy NORAD for a second time.
Yes.
Yeah, that was an issue I had, is that I know about Cheyenne Mountain. Yeah, nuclear strategy, so I'm interested in Cheyenne Mountain. The command center is way down, tunnels deep. You don't just shoot down the front door and then mow down everybody right in the entryway. They'd be way down, unprotected. They'd have to destroy the whole mountain to get to them.
Well, they're down by the Stargate, right?
Right.
Yeah. And the whole chain of command would not be there. They'd have, like, the Secretary of Education or somewhere out in the country. So, and the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff is not in the chain of command, the chain of succession, to my knowledge.
He's not.
No. I mean, if he was some de facto thing, and then they found the Secretary of Education out in Podunkaville, and he gave him the job back like you think he should, you know, the whole civilian control of the military thing, that'd be fine.
Well, also, I mean...
I'm just thinking, why the last man now? Because the Secretary of Education did become president.
Well, that's what happens to Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and it's the kind of thing that you're just like... You thought about so much other things, right? Like, you literally thought... And also, let's presume that they had made it all the way down to the basement. If that's the facts, you're hosed anyway, right? Like, if they've already breached every line of defense like that, you have no hope.
And they still have to go through like 50 stories of tunnels to get to you.
Why did they do that? Because they said they've taken out NORAD, and it didn't sound like they did a ground insurgency. It sounded like they sat over the mountain and they blew it the hell up.
Which they did in the first movie.
Yes. So why in the second movie did they go in? They could have just done it again. Oh, hey, you rebuilt? Boom.
Right. I mean, and then again, the first movie, there's this incredible scene where Brent Spiner is first, like, tentacled, right, as you do, and the alien is speaking through him because they don't have vocal cords, and he says, they want us to die and surrender, and, like, the president says, how dare you, and then he's mind-melded with the alien, and he says, they're like locusts, they go from planet to planet, steal the resources, and then move on. The idea, presumably, is that they take over our planet. That's why they'd kill us all. This one, they've decided to take the core. Frankly, something that they don't need to kill us for. They can just take the core and leave, which is what they're doing in the second movie.
They don't even need to do that. They can just go find some dead world somewhere and do that.
Yes, they could take Mercury. They could take Mars's core. Or
why did they even need it? I mean, were they using it?
They said it was fuel. They said it was fuel, which makes no sense. It's iron.
Fuel?
And B, guess what? If you just need it, don't build as many spaceships. The spaceship is more iron than I've ever seen in my life. The one in
3,000 miles wide.
That's not how science works, guys.
No.
If you just wanted iron, build less spaceships. It has no purpose.
Why even build laser cannons if you have a 3,000-mile ship that's capable of having its own gravitational pull to pull up cities? Just fly over the planet a couple times.
Yeah, you could buzz the tower a couple times and you'd be done.
Also, they turn on and off gravity. Did you notice that? Because they flew over, what was it, Hong Kong?
I think it was Singapore.
Singapore. And then they flew over London and then dropped the buildings? That's not how gravity works. You don't turn gravity on and off.
That whole scene was a lot of wasted potential, but I can rant about that when appropriate.
I will say, though, it is where my favorite line of the movie happens, because they're back on Earth. They're flying around. Jeff Goldblum is flying co-pilot to Liam Hemsworth. And he goes, man, they like destroying landmarks, don't they?
Oh, boy.
And I was just like, oh, Roland Emmerich has a little bit of sense of humor.
This movie didn't earn that joke.
Well, it's not wrong, though.
No.
The last thing I want to talk about are the two presidents. I guess three presidents. First one is the lady president who survives for 45 minutes, does the thing that all presidents do in these movies and says, oh, you guys, we don't actually believe that. Well, first they shoot a good alien ship, which we can get
that's,
to.
Yeah, the sphere.
And then the technology they use to destroy the good alien ship does nothing to the bad alien ship. And then she dies at Cheyenne Mountain.
Okay.
Then we have a new president, William Fichtner, as General Adams, then President Adams, because he's the second president. I hope you guys got that.
Ooh, history joke.
And then the third president is Bill Pullman. Bill Pullman, after the first, not only has PTSD, but apparently Alzheimer's, kind
of? And his daughter's taking care of him, who's no longer Mae Whitman, which was kind of disturbing.
Oh, actually, Mae Whitman was really ticked about that. She wanted to reprise the role, and they didn't hire her. And it was like, wait, what? She's an actress. Like,
yeah,
she's still working.
I thought she wasn't interested.
No, she was.
No, she was.
She was incredibly interested and actually kind of angry that they, like, Mara Wilson talked about it, too, that it was
yeah,
stupid.
That's right. Well, and then, and the thing is, and I say kind of like Parkinson's or kind of like whatever, because he gets cured when he gives a pretentious speech in an airplane hangar.
Yeah, which, lightning did not strike twice.
Which sounds so wheezy and out of breath. He sounds like some old man ranting into an empty basement instead of being this big, boisterous, patriotic leader.
And there's so many ways to do it. Like, have someone recognize him and go, wait, aren't you Whitmore? And he goes, I was there 20 years ago, or whatever. But this is really like, he starts giving a speech and a bunch of people barely look up. And then he can walk again. He literally puts down the cane and walks away. And you're just like,
that's not how canes work.
And it's so disrespectful to a good character the first time. Because, like, not only was he the president, but he was the president who led the final assault and saved the day. And people wanted him not to do it, and he did it anyway. The kind of thing that literally could never happen. But it's a movie, and it was a movie moment. Awesome.
That was kind of a somewhat decent moment when at first he's getting on stage and everybody's standing up and applauding him as a great war hero. And then he trips down, and he's like, they're coming back! And I'm like, aww. About half of that was good, and then you just blew it.
And, like, and again, I like Bill Pullman as an actor, and when he's flying around the second time, oh my god, okay, we have to talk about how he dies, but they just give him nothing to do other than look feeble, which he's not. He's not that old.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, this is supposed to be present day. Now, obviously, we have lots of alien technology, but I find it very difficult to believe in those same 20 years that the drone program wouldn't have occurred. Why did he have to fly it?
They referenced drones.
Yes, they did.
Clearing
they
the path
did.
Of the manned planes,
and,
which we
but
never
we never see.
See
them.
Yeah, that
But
sucked.
Drones exist. They do exist. Why did he have to fly it? You could have sent a drone out to do it. Like, it wouldn't have mattered.
Well, he lied to his daughter in order to get on the plane.
And then he goes out the Randy Quaid way, which is just flying up into the glowy bits.
I think it was just an elaborate suicide mission. He finally sees the aliens coming back and is like, sweet death has come for me.
Well, we should mention this. Okay, so we built a space laser, because why don't you build a space laser?
Oh, we built a satellite laser grid.
Which also fails because it's a plot device.
Because they,
it blew up in one shot.
They didn't remember it takes like 5 or 6 minutes to spin the thing up. Which don't they remember the Battle of Area 51 where it's firing and firing and firing?
Well, and in the battle for Area 51, right, we learned from the first round that not only do the alien ships take forever, but they fire in synchronous orbit, right? Like they all time down and then they fire all at once. And none of that mattered in this movie. But first guy shows up and it's, for whatever reason, there's so many moving parts that don't matter in this movie. Jeff Goldblum is like a UN guy who, for whatever reason, has the Ghostbusters 2 problem of he can't get funding to research alien technology when everyone is convinced the aliens are coming back, but he can't get funding to do his research or build up space defense. Doesn't make sense. He goes to Africa, like Matt was mentioning, one of the spaceships actually lands there. And so, like, there's this whole cult of the alien, which is interesting, but we spend no time with it. the spaceship that Jeff Goldblum says, don't shoot down, don't shoot down, they shoot down, and turns out he's right, they're a good guy, it looks like a different ship. Mm-hmm. And then out of it comes this sphere that apparently every alien possessee has been drawing, and when I say drawing, I mean it looks like a circle that a compass would draw. It's just a circle with a line in it.
Imagine Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
It's literally Close Encounters.
No. It is literally that moment, because when they go to the guy in Africa, he painted it or something, and it was literally like going, oh...
I kind of wish I could have seen Bill Pullman build it with mashed potatoes.
That would have been wonderful.
The sphere people are enemies of the harvesters. Why would people who have contact with the harvesters know about them?
I don't even think they're really enemies at this point. That sphere is just the last of the species.
Yeah,
isn't
but he was collecting a world where they were training the other species for war.
But I mean, like, wait, what were you asking, Matt?
The sphere is a representative of another alien race that had been fighting the harvesters for thousands of years and had a world that had survivors of other genocide they were training for war.
Mm-hmm.
But yet the people who are drawing the sphere bot in mental mode are people who have only had contact with the harvesters. Why do they know about this thing?
Plot device. No, I mean, you're right.
Convenient. Contrivance.
You're right. It's a huge contrivance. It's as though they've hacked the alien brainwaves.
Yeah, that's like some illiterate Polish peasant who fights some Nazis and suddenly is aware of the United States.
Why wouldn't he be aware of the United States in that scenario?
Well, the idea is that he's very isolated and uneducated.
That might be the best metaphor we've ever gotten on this show. And then, I mean, to further that point, they use the Occam laser... Which cuts this giant glowy sphere, which really looks like a prop out of, well, we've said several things. A bunch of you guys thought it was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's just a white sphere that glows. Yeah. And when you touch it, it like absorbs language out of you. And it says, well, we know what the harvesters are. Let's defeat it. And they're like, well, humanity's going to lose. So we're going to leave this planet. And they're like, no, stay here. It's the stupidest plot. It really is. But ultimately they try to figure out its radio frequency so that they can convince the other spaceships, right, that where it is, because they want to destroy the sphere, right, I guess?
Yeah, because it's basically they're afraid of the sphere. That's kind of what they were trying to say is why they were all drawing it, is what the aliens feared.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they wanted – the idea was they use the sphere because the sphere people – have the home world where they've got the resistance thing going.
But they have the technology to fight the aliens.
To lure the Harvester Queen to kill her.
What I would have done if I were writing this script is...
Drink heavily?
Well, not make it 20 years in the future and make the technology a little bit advanced, but not crazy advanced, because then the whole thing seems ridiculous.
5 years.
I would have loved it to be Jeff Goldblum and someone else running around trying to figure out what these spheres mean, like why the alien, like what the leftover technology, maybe trying to figure out why that ship turned on and then use it against the aliens. But so much of this is like, our new technology will save us, and it's failing, and it will save us, and it will fail, and then it will save us, and then ultimately it does save them. It's there's no stakes. It's boring.
Yeah, there's never that moment where it's like you outthought them. It was glorious in the first movie where, like, you know, Jeff Goldblum is literally drinking himself into an abyss because he can't figure it out, and he's supposed to be the smartest guy in the room. And then, you know, his dad makes this one-off comment, and it hits him. It's like, you know, that epiphany.
Yeah.
And it was glorious. It was just kind of a wonderful – it was almost an homage to the original War of the Worlds. What finally takes down the aliens? A virus. Instead of being an actual virus, it's a computer virus. It's wonderful.
It's literally the simplest thing. And it's something that even in the deeply flawed movie, M. Night Shyamalan does well in Signs. The idea is that the simplest thing can take – like, because they don't understand what's most fundamental about us or something like that, right? Here it's just like, let's make a big budget movie. Like, that's really it. A big budget movie. This movie is 25 minutes shorter than the first Independence Day.
It is? And it feels longer.
And it feels so much longer.
I did not know that until you just said it.
I kept looking at my watch.
Yeah.
It's 2 hours and 1 minute. The first one's almost 2.5.
Jeez.
Like, that is a shame. Because this movie has no charm to it. Even that scene you were talking about. It's a very dramatic scene because Jeff Goldblum is the one that, in many ways, he cracked the code. He isn't using his brilliance. He needs his brilliance. He figures everything out, and then he hits a dead end, and he's just hammered. Like, he's drinking, and his former love interest is like, you're going to destroy yourself. He goes, okay. And so he literally, the next scene is him destroying everything he can get his hands on, and his dad is there because it's always a two-hander. Here, it seems like half the scenes, the charismatic people are talking to walls. It's a shame.
It's almost as if... No, because think about it. He and his dad only have one scene together in the entire film. Really. You almost wonder, because there's definitely not just rumors that Jeff Goldblum is a bore to work with. He's a pain in the ass.
I'm sure.
That probably, you know, the guy was like, I don't want to... No, I don't want anything to do with this guy.
Really? Jeff Goldblum's a pain?
Oh, yeah, he's a diva. Completely. There's a reason why he kind of disappeared from Hollywood. He keeps disappearing for lengths of time because he's really hard to work with.
And he needs the right director to be kind of perfectionistic. I mean, that's why you can do something with someone like Wes Anderson, because there's very specific ways he works. That being said, here he had no direction. Like, here he had the opposite problem. It's just like, Jeff, you do what you want. And it felt like he wandered around. But again, then you need someone else to lighten the scene, because there's a lot of him looking like traumatized, but nothing happening.
Yeah, and as we said earlier, no stakes raising. Like, you never hit this, you know, that point. The Jeff Goldblum wall is a wonderful scene. It's a wonderful, like, bit of the arc. It's just this pause. Like, you're sitting there and you're really wondering, how the hell are we going to get out of this? And you're watching this movie and I'm like, I never felt that point hit. Or if it did, I just didn't care.
Yeah. No, exactly right. Now, we've been talking a while, guys. And again, this is a movie that's currently out. So if you want to see it, go ahead. I wouldn't recommend it unless you just like the special effects, which at times were very charming. They were pretty.
But don't say we didn't warn you.
Yeah, don't say we didn't warn you. In fact, this is one of those weird movies, just like, I don't know, Batman versus Superman, that in some ways it's better to see on the big screen just so you can see the effects full on. But I wouldn't recommend it outside of it. However, we should go around and give our final judgments. We'll start with Thomas. We'll just go around the horn.
Okay. If you're looking for a fairly big budget sci-fi alien movie to watch, go back, watch the original Independence Day, and just skip this one.
Yeah. No, thank you. Matt?
So much wasted potential. I like the idea of a 2016 with alien super tech and war in space and so on and so forth. It could have been so much better than what we got. I'm going to, at some point, write a blog post how I would have done it, like I did for Mortal Kombat.
Mm-hmm.
So, World According to Quinn fans, take heart. There'll be something awesome coming soon.
Thank you.
Wait for the Dollar Theater.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt. Sorry. Daniel, go ahead.
Okay, I've got kind of a long-winded analogy that I think is going to work.
Yeah.
All right. Imagine you're in high school, and you're a really nerdy, introverted guy. You go to your prom, you're going stag, of course, and then you see the prom queen get crowned, and she looks like the most beautiful person you've ever seen. And you imagine what it'd be like to be with that person. Well, 20 years pass. You've read more, you've grown up a lot, you're more successful now, and you have a different view of the world, and suddenly she calls you out of the blue and wants to catch up. So you go catch up, and you realize that she is shallow. She has not grown at all in the 20 years since you first saw her, and she can't convince you to like her. That's pretty much the experience I had watching Independence Day Resurgence.
Thank you. You should read his review on The Corner Critic as well, which is good. I guess my final thought is, this movie is made up of other movies. Pick your favorite part and watch the movie it's based on. We already did Starship Troopers. I think 3/4 of us liked it. There's a lot of Starship Troopers in this. If you want to see the aliens being creepy and attacking space marines, watch Aliens. You know, like, if you want to see them even kill the queen, to see Aliens 3, because it's better than this.
Or them.
Yeah. And, I mean, there's no stakes here, and there's no charisma, and there's no nothing. Watch the first one, and that's it. We don't do the on-screens often, and I doubt we'll do a lot of them in the future, except for probably Bond movies. But please, I hope you like this, and I hope you tune in. We as you saw, we talked for over 40 minutes, and we couldn't say no. But tune in, tune in every episode, man, because we're going to throw actually your past on trial, not your last week. Thanks, guys.
Myopia Defend Your Childhood is produced by Dude Letter Podcasting. It's hosted by Nick Hoffman, produced and mixed by Ann Burns, and edited by Nick Hoffman. Our graphic designer is Scott Miller. The theme song is Caroline, written and performed by The Serenaders. Purchase their music through the Amazon link on dudeletter.com. Questions or comments? Please visit myopiapodcast.com or contact us through myopiapodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @myopiapodcast and @dudeletter, and find us on our Facebook, Stitcher, and iTunes pages. And while you're on iTunes, please rate and review our podcast. It helps us out a lot. Want to give us money? Go to myopiapodcast.com/Amazon and purchase stuff like normal. Myopia gets a piece of the action.
Yeah, I posted the Alternate History Facebook group on Twitter that this is probably the top grossing, most prominent alternate history movie of all time. And it's been pointed out in Back to the Future 2.
Yeah.
And Back to the Future 2 made a similar amount of money at a much lower budget.
Yeah.
And in the 80s, or in the 90s, so the inflation is probably much bigger. 80.
No, I thought 89 and 90.
89 and 90,
good. Actually, what I was also thinking was, what defines alternate history?
Well, the idea that they decided that the war of 1996 happened in 1996. So the entire, and I noted in my, after reading the book, part of it, that basically, the idea is the 1990s never ended. Like you, like in the book, they talk about the one-child policy in Tibet.
Well, right, but what makes like so the fact that like, you could say that Day of Future Past is alternate history if mutants existed. Like, what makes that not alternate history?
Because they decided to
technically any movie is alternate history. It's taking place in our. It's taking place in our universe just with fictional characters.
Like, as opposed to Back to the Future 2, where there's, like, one specific inciting incident which makes an alternative history, but, like, if they're aliens, they're
From the very beginning, Back to the Future, he creates, he creates an alternate present, and he does. Because
right.
Everybody's doing all those changes. Right. Yeah, and then, so.
Well, no, I mean, it's just, that's why I'm asking, like, what defines alternate history? Because you could almost say that, like,
what about
Gods and Generals is alternate history because Ted Turner wasn't that important in the Civil War.
Hmm.
Well, the idea is that instead of setting the movie in, like, you know, saying it took place in the near future or whenever, they said it was a war of 1996.
Well, that makes sense, though, because it was a sequel to a movie that came out in 96. I think it was more for nostalgia's sake and trying to call back than trying to create its own universe.
Or like a Django Unchained would be a great.
Yeah.
Or Inglourious Bastards would be alternate history.
Inglourious Bastards, yeah. Django Unchained, you could say was something maybe wasn't well known.
One story.
Yeah, because no one would have known that he killed all those people and blew the house up.
Well,
it would just be the house blew up.
If you pay attention, at the beginning they say something like 1848, 12 years before the Civil War. Technically, that'd be 13 years before the Civil War.
So it's an alternative typo.
There you go.
actually, this just beat out Wild Wild West, which would be a definitely alternate history. That might be a stay tuned. Although, I don't remember much of that movie when I first saw it because I was making out with my friend's sister at the time.
There you go.